And off, ladies and gentlemen. It's obviously a delight for us all to be welcoming Lord Darrendorf here tonight to open the first of the special centenary lectures we have for the year of past directors. Lord Darrendorf opens for us tonight. We have IG Patel and John Ashworth later on in the year. I feel that the career of Ralph is one that absolutely needs no heavy breathing elaboration from me, especially here among you. I think he began his directorship here by bringing students into this hall, probably, right? And saying in the first few hours that he had learned one thing about LSE, and that was that there were those who were at LSE, two kinds of people, those who were at LSE and those who wanted to be. His time in career with us is something that I want to touch on in a special way, because he means so much to many people right around the world, but he means something pretty special with us. I hear him described so often as a Renaissance man. Actually, I think of him when I review this extraordinary distinguished career. I think of him as a frontiers man, a man who has moved and crossed frontiers all his career. He has crossed frontiers geographically, nationally, politically, academically, in business terms. He's been a member of the board of some of the great outstanding international companies in the world. He has been, in a sense, the ideal LSE man from the start. One way to describe the spirit of LSE is indeed the crossing of frontiers. His first encounter with LSE was in the 50s. He came here in the early 50s to take a PhD, I think, in 1956. Even by that time, the career was remarkable. Born in Hamburg, he came through the war. He grew up just in Berlin, just because it was a matter of surviving. His family was part of the resistance against the Nazis. His father was on trial after the July 20th plot. He himself was arrested and put in a camp for his opposition as a schoolboy. Then he came out of university, went to Hamburg, and got his doctorate there, came here for sociology. When he next came here, his second encounter with us was, of course, when he was appointed director in 74. And that was some decade. By that time, he brought with him a political record because he had been an active liberal member in Germany and had become a junior minister, I think, in Willy Brandt's government. He'd also been internationally known as a dynamic commissioner in the European community, first in external trade and external relations, and then in research and education and science. And then he came here. And the process also, I think, at that time, beginning of his settling in this country. I think some measure of the significance of those years for the school can be taken in a couple of recent events. First, not so long ago, he was elevated to the House of Lords. And it was a matter, I think, of general pleasure when that had happened to this new British citizen in this country. But it was special pleasure for us, and a special glow for us, when he chose to become Baron Darrendorf of Clare Market in the city of Westminster. This was a compliment deeply felt by the worldwide community of LSE. The second thing that happened recently, that again gives us some measure of what the decade of his directorship has meant for this school and for himself, was that when we came to prepare for the centenary year, we naturally needed the history of the school to be taken on, and who was more natural to do that than Ralph? And in fact, that history, I'm sure, will be a jewel in this crowning year of our centenary. Actually, I speak without the book. I think we have not yet had the book itself. And no one has been able to lay their hands on the advanced copies. Even the chairman of the court is guessing a little bit. But may I say that that makes us all the more eager, Ralph, to hear you speak tonight on this theme, which is the theme, I suppose, of much of the book, the historical perspectives of LSE and the social sciences, Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your generous words of introduction, but thank you in particular for inviting me to speak here about the history of LSE before my book is published, because the person who led the research team to which I owe so much, Shirley Chapman, quite rightly warned me some time ago that once the book is published, I better leave the country. I'd certainly better not come here. Another member of the research team, Fiona Plowman, has meticulously prepared the index of the book, but I shudder to think of two categories of friends: those who look at the index and don't find their names, and those who find their names and then look at the text and are deeply disappointed by what is said about them. So this is more or less the last possible moment for me to come safely to the school and talk about a subject of passionate interest. Passionate indeed. I would be tempted to say that I love the school, were it not for the fact that one of my favorite German politicians, Gustav Heinemann, who was president of the Federal Republic from 1969 to 74, and was known for his low-key remarks, was once challenged by an exasperated journalist who said, "But President, don't you love your country?" And he said, "I love my wife. I don't love my country." Well, I love my wife, but both of us have a very strong sense of affection for this institution, stronger than perhaps for any other institution. We suffer with it when it's going through a difficult patch. We rejoice when it's doing well. And we feel that this is more than just another academic institution. And we feel that despite the fact that LSE has always been overcrowded. It's always been grubby and slightly untidy. It's always been rather shambolic. There are none of the obvious nice things you can say about LSE, and yet perhaps that's one aspect of this wonderful and remarkable place. There are many reasons, incidentally, why people feel so strongly about the school and have done so through the decades. In the early decades, I suspect these feelings have a lot to do with the personal experiences of evening students. And evening students were, for a very long time, the heart and the soul of the London School of Economics, certainly up to the Second World War. They lived a most extraordinarily difficult and hard life, because these were people, for the most part, who had full-time jobs, and after having done their day's work, they came here for 2 or 3 or 4 hours of instruction, of academic work. Their workmates must have thought that they are very strange indeed. But here at the school, they found a home, and a home which left them with a very strong sense of affection for the school. The school is not, and wasn't at any time in its history, what Irving Goffman called a total institution. It was never true that you couldn't get out of it if you wanted to, but it did have a very strong sense of community, a sense of community which was probably felt most acutely by the two generations which came to the school after the two wars. It seems to me that one could write a special chapter about those who came after 1920, and Lionel Robbins, of course, has written about that time and what it felt like to be a student here at that time. And one certainly can, and I may return to that, write a special chapter about those who came in the decade after the last war. Then there is this explosive fault line between scholarship and politics, which has been a part of the school from its beginnings, which has tempted people either way, which has been felt by so many who were here, where there was always some rumbling going on underneath, where there was always some threat or possibility of eruption, where people protected themselves from the political temptations outside by almost overemphasizing the scholarly purity of the social sciences, and at the same time left this scholarly purity in order to indulge for periods, and some of them for their entire careers at the school. There were the great teachers. I was struck in looking at the history of the school by the importance of teaching in the history of LSE. Teaching almost more than the publications which emerged from this institution. And it was an interesting kind of teaching. I certainly experienced it in the 1950s, but I see many here who experienced it earlier or at the same time or later, because it was neither the one-to-one teaching situation which may be characteristic of Oxford or Cambridge, nor was it the American type of teaching, where the Nobel laureate lectures to 600 people and then graduates wait at the doors to split them up into smaller groups and continue a process of indoctrination or whatever it is that these graduates do. Throughout its history, it was characteristic of LSE that a room like this one was used for teaching, and there were no graduates waiting at the doors. That is, the large lecture was for a very, very long period in the history of the school the characteristic form of instruction. And it meant, of course, that we, the students, had to do something after these lectures. And again, throughout the history, it's been characteristic of the place that students then organized their own groups, their own groups in which they continued their interest in the subjects which they were taught, apart from the classes which obviously also existed. But it's quite striking that, and no consolation today, I'm sure, Director, but it is quite striking that the staff-student ratio at LSE throughout its history was, in comparative and international terms, pretty miserable. But it was a staff-student ratio which was coupled with a particular attitude to the teaching experience and one which has produced many memories in many minds. And then, of course, there is London. There is this great metropolis, itself an almost unbearable mass of noise and pollution and of commuters and locals, of traffic, of all the things which get on your nerves at times, but at other times stimulate you to keep your mind active and alive. London, forever inviting, forever threatening, all the way around the school very much a part of this great city. Add to that the sense of adventure which accompanied the history of the school, and by that I mean the sense of adventure about the social sciences. The social sciences around which this institution exists, and about which I shall make a few comments, not very systematic. This is perhaps not an occasion for a systematic academic lecture, more in order to convey some of the sense of what made this school tick. When the school was founded 100 years ago, the social sciences were essentially a hope. The hope that it should be and would be possible to emulate the comparatively recent successes of the natural sciences in the study of society, and to emulate not only the discoveries of the natural sciences, but also the potential of applying them to improve the conditions in which one is living. It was a time in which, from a whole variety of angles, great people have begun to focus on questions of society. They've begun to focus, like Spencer, on the unfolding of history as he saw it. They've begun to focus, like Francis Galton, on the social mysteries of biology, like Fraser on primitive peoples, like Charles Booth on poverty, and his maps of poverty in London tell one part of the physical story of the London School of Economics, especially the ones of this particular part of town. And then there was one of the complicated figures at the time of the foundation of LSE, Alfred Marshall in Cambridge, who was invited to be helpful, even a part of the early school, and yet stayed away from it, and whose relationship with the early members of the school, especially the first director and the first economists, was not free of tension. Indeed, a tension which has come to define the position of that central subject, economics, at LSE for several decades. The hope which prevailed at the time was one of a social science, first of all. In the early years, social science was a generously defined endeavor. It was one where one couldn't really say that it was just one discipline, but it was an attempt on the part of people with different perspectives to try and come to terms with the same set of social phenomena. Reality wasn't carved up in any way. What was carved up was at the most, and that was barely the right word to call it carved up, was at the most the way in which one tried to understand social events. Just to mention a few names. The first director, W.A.S. Hewins, was an economic historian, I suppose. He was incidentally, and I mentioned this in passing, I must beware of not trying to tell you everything that's in the book, but leave a few little points of interest in there. He was 29 years old when he became director of the school. The school was founded by people who, even in terms of their own time, might be regarded as fairly young. Sidney Webb was 36. That perhaps wasn't regarded as quite so young, but still, here they were. Two young men who had this idea which only the two of them really pursued. One talks of the Fabians and so on and so forth. Ultimately, it was these two. And they pursued it by starting a courses of lectures at the Royal Society of Arts and at the Chamber of Commerce. And many of these lectures were given by the director himself, Hewins. And he lectured not only on economic history, but also on economics. And economics and economic history were not very different for him, it is true. There was also Edwin Cannon, an economist who never left Oxford, in fact, who was an Oxford city councillor, who therefore had to finish his lectures, I think, at precisely 5 minutes to six, because at the time, one could apparently predict that one would then get the 6:20 train from Paddington to be back in time for the evening meetings of the Oxford City Council. But Hewins lectured on a broad range of issues, giving essentially a historical perspective on economic phenomena, and not just economic phenomena. Halford Mackinder, one of the early teachers at the school, the second director, the one who succeeded Hewins, a geographer who was an impressive lecturer by all accounts, and who particularly enjoyed bringing maps to life, producing maps and then talking about them so that his audience saw not only the physical contours of parts of the world, but saw the people who were living there, the conditions under which they were living, their history. And Mackinder did not find it necessary to distinguish between geography, anthropology, history, whatever the subjects would be, which we name today, indeed, economics and politics. And so he gave his famous lectures on the geographical pivot of history, on the parts of Europe which he thought were central and from which the future would be determined, rather like people nowadays may speak about the Far East or the emerging countries. A great lecturer. Graham Wallace, political scientist, yes, but a political scientist who was at the same time a psychologist and an institutional analyst, one who talked about political ideas as much as about political organization, one whom it would be hard to put into any particular pigeonhole in modern terms, another aspect of society. Departments in this period wouldn't have made any sense at all. Of course, it is one of the secrets, in part perhaps one of the myths, but one of the secrets of LSE that departments didn't exist for a very long time indeed. They were an afterthought, perhaps one of the 60s. This is not entirely the case, but it is true that in this early period, departments wouldn't have made sense at all. And there was endless overlap between Hewins and Mackinder and Wallace, and even that marvelous man, Arthur Bowley, whose ironic descriptions of events in the early period of the school belong to the most wonderful presentations of what LSE was like. Arthur Bowley, who was a statistician and who certainly was a great man of numbers, but whose interest in numbers extended across a whole range from what we would now call statistics to what we would now call demography, to what we would now call econometrics, to what in some ways we would now call aspects of macroeconomics. He, again, did not see any particular boundaries, nor did, to mention yet another name, L.T. Hobhouse, the sociologist, the author, for example, of Morals in Evolution, Philosophy and History, and Philosophy of History, all being part and parcel of his particular approach to politics and to society. General sociology, he called it, but he might as well have called it general social science. I'm not suggesting that these people were all doing the same thing. They were not. But I am suggesting that they were all trying to come to grips with an area of experience and of reality on which they were very largely agreed, which they didn't define differently. They didn't define it in subject terms. They had their different approaches. They didn't bother much about overlap and disciplinary boundaries. They were trying to understand society. All this, ladies and gentlemen, began to change quite significantly in the 1920s. This original unity of interest, if not of perspective, turned in the 1920s into the development of social science disciplines. And if one looks at the contribution of the great teachers of the 1920s and 30s and 40s, to some extent, one finds that almost every one of them has defined a discipline and is remembered for having defined a discipline in terms which are actually quite different from the early period before the First World War, in terms which are much closer to what we know today, almost in terms which lead to the creation of different scientific communities in these disciplines. It is strange in this connection to mention Lionel Robbins first, because he himself enjoyed so much the courses which LSE offered to him as a student and which enabled him to cut across disciplinary boundaries. And he certainly, throughout his long and active life, always emphasized the need to look across disciplinary boundaries. But a good case can be made for saying that he is much remembered by his early book on the nature and significance of economic science. And this book on the nature and significance of economic science, to some even today, defines an economics which could no longer be taught by W.A.S. Hewins. An economics which has its own area of expertise, scarcity, and its analysis, choice, and its analysis, its own area of expertise, and which is at least the beginning of that modern development of economics, to some extent away from the company of the other social sciences. And one of the interesting and great issues in contemporary social science is whether the rediscovery of political economy may help us recreate bridges which, for a decade or two decades or more, for a generation perhaps, seemed absent, if not broken. But Robbins's influence was very strongly, Lionel Robbins's influence was very strongly through the nature and significance and through the definition of economics. Even Harold Laski, arguably the greatest teacher in the history of the school, did define, discipline is a word one hesitates to use when one speaks about Laski, but did define a subject. He did define a subject. It was quite clear that Lasky was not an economist. It was quite clear that Lasky was not a psychologist. He was not a philosopher. The Grammar of Politics may not be the greatest book, and it may not even be a grammar of politics, since it is full of comments on current and contemporary events, and like so many of Lasky's books, was not destined to last. But the way he approached political issues was, in a sense, a definition of one version of political studies, not to say political science. Malinowski, the anthropologist, author of A Scientific Theory of Culture, and note the titles of these books, written in the 1920s. Author of A Scientific Theory of Culture, strange and fascinating mind, with this great contradiction between, on the one hand, his experience of the Tatra peasants, the Gorals, and on the other hand, his training with the Vienna School of Mach and others, and the somewhat perhaps mechanical classificatory theoretical notions which he derived from that particular training. But he turned anthropology into a subject in its own right. It is least easy to make a similar point for the man of whom I have come to believe that he may be closest to the soul of the school in its whole history, and that is Tawney. Tawney, quite clearly, was not a man of any particular disciplinary boundaries, although he wasn't an economist in the sense of the 1920s, and he wasn't an anthropologist in the sense of the 1920s, and he wasn't a political scientist in the sense of the 1920s. Indeed, he represented a discipline which has had a certain synthetic quality throughout the history of the social sciences and is reacquiring that quality in most recent years. That's economic history. In his case, an economic history of understanding, of Verstehen. More recently, an economic history which appears to be the only discipline which effectively bridges the quantitative and theoretical approaches of economics and the qualitative approaches of history and related disciplines. However that may be, Tawney played this important role in his time, quite apart from his many, many other interests, including the interest in the application of social science in what the school chose to call social science, that is the application of social science in applied social policy, teaching and research, for which for a while he had some considerable responsibility. Well, and then, as I talk about the 20s, I cannot but mention, 20s and 30s, cannot but mention the person around whom one of the great controversies in the history of the school developed, Lancelot Hogben, the social biologist. The social biologist who was invited to come here to give the school a more scientific flavor in the strict sense of the word. And the social biologist whose experiments on South African toads created not only an extraordinary smell, but also a great deal of controversy at LSE in the 1930s. And there's some retired porters still around who can tell you stories about their discoveries when they looked at the rubbish bins in the mornings. Lancelot Hogben, who tried to be truly scientific and did not get terribly far at LSE at the time, and in the end had to leave under not altogether happy circumstances. The school, as I see it, ladies and gentlemen, had two great directors in its history. And they were presiding over the two great periods of its history. They were very different. They succeeded each other. But their role as directors, their activity as directors, spans almost 38 years of the first 100 years. And they are William Beveridge and Alexander Carr Saunders. William Beveridge, when he came in 1919-20, found a school which was there and there to stay, but which by no means had a very clearly defined sense of direction or of purpose. It also had very little money. And despite the fact that after the war, there were many young people, many not so young, who felt that this was the place where they wanted to go in order to find out about the causes of things, there was a great need for a strong sense of where the school should go. Beveridge had many weaknesses. The greatest, perhaps, was that he himself actually had a rather narrow notion of what science is about. He was very much of the school, not totally alien to the Webbs, of those who thought that the collection of facts is all you really need to do. Indeed, he had a profound dislike of theorists, which meant that from an early day onwards, he turned against the economists, whom he regarded as theorists, and they turned against him. Not quite so early, but they did turn against him in the critical period, in which, in the end, he had to leave because his position was no longer tenable. It could also be said that Beveridge had management attitudes which were not liked by everybody. Although when you read my book, and I trust some of you will find some extent a defense of Jesse Mayer. I don't count the role of the then secretary of the school among the great tragedies of LSE. I think the interesting, strange, probably in an explicit sense non-sexual, but nevertheless extremely close relationship between William Beveridge and Jesse Mayer was for the school on the whole a source of strength. Because in this period, the school was put on a firm financial basis, and Beveridge managed to attract, in many of the subjects I mentioned and many of those I didn't mention, teachers who became great names in the history of the school. In scholarly terms, I think it all happened in the Beveridge years. That is the great unfolding of the social sciences, leaving this original period in which minds with different angles of scholarly vision concentrated on the same subject. After that initial period, the unfolding of the separate social sciences as such and their first blossoming has all happened in the Beveridge years. And so these Beveridge years were a triumph for the London School of Economics as the source of inquiry and investigation into things social in a whole variety and range of discipline. It is this school which has had an effect on the whole world and which has had a major influence on the development of the social sciences worldwide. And it is for that reason, if I may turn it back to the work which I did on the book, that the Beveridge years are really the central part of the history which I have written. But they were followed by 20 years of a very different man, of Alexander Carr Saunders, a lovable director, and a much-loved director, despite the fact that he could be cool and remote, but he was much-loved. And in his period, it is not so much the spreading of the social sciences, the articulation of the social sciences, but the teaching of the social sciences, which I would emphasize. Karl Saunders had a difficult job. Less than 2 years after he was appointed director, he had to find a place for this school because the war broke out. But as so many things which he did in his life, he'd thought about it in advance, and therefore he managed to do something which University College and others in London failed to do, and that is find one place where LSE, or what was left of it, was going. The school was not split up into 6 or 7 or 8 different parts, but what was left of it went to Cambridge, went to Peterhouse, survived the war there, and it is a similar achievement of his that from an early point onwards he insisted that the school has to come back to London, and has to come back to London as soon as at all possible after the end of the war, and managed to bring about this transition. I suspect in student terms, in terms of student experiences, the second decade of Karl Saunders' directorship, the decade after the war and right up to 1957, is the greatest period in the history of this institution. It was in this period that a large number of people from all over the world had the unique experience of exposure to lively social sciences, which had somewhere to go, which wanted to go somewhere, and had a great sense of exploration combined with a great sense of community. And as you, Mr. Chairman, indicated in your introductory comments, it was in this period that I first came here in 1952. And since at the time I was lucky enough to get a Leverhulme studentship, I even had a chance to see the director, which wasn't necessarily the case for all students at all times, even then. I'm sorry, no comment. It's a comment on me, not on my successors, who may be more accessible than I was in my time. It is also a time in which I learned as much from my teachers and lecturers as I did from the seminar which we, the postgraduates, organized ourselves. And many of us who were there at the time remember this seminar as much as the direct effect of teachers. And why not? It is, in any case, the school which is now remembered by many. Now, I have said little so far, almost nothing, about the other side of this great historical theme of the school, the exploration and application of the social sciences. And there is this other side, and it is of equal importance, equally interesting, equally difficult to put into a few words, so that as I do so, I have to apologize for being all too brief in my statements and therefore sounding more dogmatic than I want to be. The other day we had in this room a little of the dispatch box banter, which is fashionable, about the old question of LSE and socialism, and has LSE betrayed the desire of its founders to spread the cause of socialism all over the world. That's fine so far as it goes, but the facts are actually much more interesting and have very little to do with this particular theme, or at least have very little to do directly with this particular theme. I'm a liberal, and I don't mean by that a party liberal at all. I mean that I'm someone who has a very strong preference for human activity in civil society and for what people do in the associations which they create themselves, compared to what happens by the actions of governments and authorities. Indeed, I quite like a bit of creative chaos, and am not particularly ruled by the dream that all things human should be terribly orderly and planned. I sometimes felt that I was the first director of the school who was a liberal in this sense. Huynh's, the founder, later became a Conservative Member of Parliament and was, above all, an imperialist, a Conservative imperialist, that is, in favor of tariff reform along the lines of a restricted space within which trade should be possible rather than an open internationalism. The next directors were actually all members of liberal parties, but were certainly not liberals in the sense in which I've just hinted at the meaning of the term. Harford Mackinder also became an MP. He was a liberal imperialist. So he really shared many of the views of his predecessor. William Pember Reeves had been a New Zealand liberal, only, I dare say, because at that time there was not yet a New Zealand Labour Party. So while he was called a liberal when he was a minister there before he came to London, I think his position was certainly one which was closer to the desire to use the state for planning and creating order. William Beveridge became a liberal MP for a short period, short and unhappy period, when under the all-party agreement he succeeded a liberal MP in Northumberland in Berwick in 1944, and managed to be both one of the most popular men in the whole kingdom in 1945 and one of the few reformers who were not re-elected in the 1945 general election. I suspect, although I don't really know, because characteristically there's little evidence about this side of his life, that Carl Saunders was a liberal, and I know as little about Sidney Kane and Walter Adams. But I suspect many of them had Liberal Party affiliations, but somehow or other, the school itself was born out of a different attitude. To me, having looked reasonably closely now to that period in the 1890s, the most striking feature of the intellectual climate in which LSE was born is that it was anti-Gladstone. The school was very much a foundation against a period of individualist liberalism, very much a foundation which, against this individualist liberalism, emphasized other ways of tackling issues of society. And it was, in that sense, a product of that great fashion of the post-Gladstonian 1890s collectivism. Collectivism was then a good word, a positive word, one which is very similar in its original meaning to the communitarianism of the 1990s. It was essentially a word which was supposed to say what we want is less competition between individuals and more solidarity. And this solidarity can be brought about by all manner of things, in a whole lot of ways, but it does require some deliberate action on the part of public institutions And in that sense, it requires an emphasis on the objective of an organized good society and the instrument of a public administration which is motivated by motives of service and the desire to create such a good society. It is in this climate that one has to see the early history of the school. And it is incidentally, and I say this above all for the economists among you, it is incidentally in this connection that it is particularly fascinating to look at the school and its relationship with two of the greatest, perhaps the two greatest economic figures in the country in the last century, Alfred Marshall and Keynes. In both cases, not an altogether happy relationship, and in both cases, a degree of unhappiness in the relationship which has something to do, not directly and not in any simple way, with the particular reaction built into the foundation of the school against a kind of liberalism or individualism. Now, in fact, and I have to say this and make it quite clear, a great academic institution is never just of one ilk. And in fact, it would be quite wrong to claim that there was just one particular view, one particular set of attitudes, one particular climate of opinion in this great institution, either before the First World War or in the interwar period. In fact, all kinds of views were represented. And in the end, members of the school served the country and other countries in all sorts of positions. I just remind you of these positions before I come to my concluding remarks, and it is perhaps appropriate that I should emphasize that the effect of the school, the whole impact of the social sciences through the London School of Economics became most evident during the war in this country and in the post-war years internationally. During the war in this country, it really is extraordinary how virtually every member of staff of the London School of Economics made some contribution to the war effort, many in areas of their expertise. In statistics like Grebenick, in geography like Stamp, in law like Smith and Chorley, in other areas, especially in important positions in Washington like Roy Allen and Coase, and Tawney and Webster, and others in Cairo, in Turkey, and in other places. And then last but not least, of course, the economic section of the War Cabinet, which was led so effectively from an early point onwards by Lionel Robbins, and where James Mead was one of the members, and Harold Wilson, incidentally, another. But it was in this period of national emergency, and let's not forget it, a heightened role of governmental institutions, that members of LSE made possibly their most visible contribution to the world around them, and a great and important contribution it was. The social sciences, their best. Internationally, well, that's a big and in itself fascinating story. Some of you may remember the article which Pat Moynihan published one day about the United States in opposition, in which he complained that in the United Nations, the United States always finds itself in a minority. And as one inspects the majority, one discovers that most of its members had been at the London School of Economics. He doesn't say it in quite such crass terms, but that's really the thrust of his argument. In this particular article, which actually gained him the ambassadorship to the United Nations under a president who was not of his own party, he did not immediately confess that he himself had been at LSE. and that therefore it wasn't all of one color of one kind, nor did he mention David Rockefeller or Paul Volcker or indeed Senator Tower, for those who remember him, a number of other leading American politicians whom one would not necessarily identify with the international left and its sinister doings in the United Nations. It is actually interesting to look at what LSE alumni did in the newly independent countries. A closer look undoubtedly shows that in a number of countries, the leaders were former students at the school, like Kenyatta. But it is to me more striking that in many more countries, the LSE people were actually ministers of finance or governors of central banks. This means that they were, in almost all cases, part of the new revolutionary movements, without any doubt. Strongly in favor of independence, without any doubt. For all the social reforms which the early independence leaders all advocated, without any doubt. But in this scheme of things, they had the one position or set of positions which represents, as it were, the reality principle. They were probably much disliked by some of their friends because, as one knows, ministers of finance are the people who have to say no, whereas others can make demands and have high hopes for well-financed change. So they were a part of the innovative process, but they were an interesting part of the innovative process, one which combined a particular kind of intellectual expertise with the emotions and the politics which they shared with the early advocates and fighters for independence in what was soon to be called the Third World. Now, in conclusion, is all this history? In one sense, it is. There clearly are changes which make it, and have made it for the last 30 years almost, but certainly for the last 25 years, very unlikely that the Beveridge years or the Carsonis years can be continued or repeated. One reason is the simple one of expansion. Actually, at LSE, expansion for a very long time was expansion within. The school which for decades was two schools, the day and the evening school, the school for day students and for evening students, suddenly became a school, or not suddenly, but over the years of the 60s became a school for day students only. And that made it obviously much more crowded than if you split the student body in two. So the initial expansion was actually not one in overall numbers. It was one in numbers present at any given time. Later, there followed the actual increase in numbers, and given the site and the opportunities of the site, a massive increase in numbers, which was inevitable for a variety of reasons. And I'm myself guilty of having initiated a good part of it, but which has clearly changed things. Expansion has changed the role of the school in other ways too. There are rivals. There are competitors all over the place. The school no longer can claim any kind of monopoly or half monopoly on assembling the social sciences as few or no other institutions in the world do. At the same time, much of the unity of the social sciences was lost. I don't believe that this is merely an organizational matter. In other words, it is not just the formal creation of departments and the recognition that departments have conveners which led to this loss in the unity of the social sciences. Indeed, organizationally, the school has tried for a very long time and still tries to maintain what must be the fiction of a single faculty school, but a very useful fiction it is, one which I certainly thought was worth preserving. But there is no question that the separate scientific communities of different social science disciplines have gone their own ways, and there is therefore no question that intellectually as much as organizationally, it has become very, very difficult indeed to move across these boundaries, especially if you want to go on to an academic career where much of your success is measured in terms of your ability to persuade your peers by publishing in a particular set of journals and concentrating on recognition by those who assess you and who in one way or another have responsibility for your opportunities to move forward. An application? Well, in one sense, the application of the social sciences is everywhere. But in another sense, I need hardly tell you that we are going, especially in this country, through a phase in which there is widespread public and political doubt in the value of the social sciences, a period in which the social sciences have not found it easy to defend themselves and have perhaps not done enough to defend themselves, a period in which a government could decree that there cannot be a social science research council because there's no such thing as a social science, and therefore it had to be called the Economic and Social Research Council. A period, in other words, in which many of the tremendous hopes of the early decades of the London School of Economics are no longer there as hopes, but are there as subject or an embattled community of social scientists, which has as much to say as any of its predecessors did, but which has a smaller audience, fewer who actually want to listen. And yet, Mr. Chairman, here it is, this great, this unique center for the social sciences, teaching, research. Here are the great tensions between the world outside and the world of scholarship. Here's the natural internationalism of LSE, and here's that sense of community which still makes it almost possible to say, I love the London School of Economics.
Right on the hour. Goodness, we have a reception where we can talk over this in a relaxed way, as indeed you have in a remarkable way, Ralph, given us a splendid evening in a relaxed way, but bringing issues up which are enormously significant, not simply in the past, but for the future. In every centenary event I think of, I find we're in the nicest way two-faced. I mean, one face, a sort of rather lined and worn face, but still good humor, we look back and count our blessings. The other face is the fresh face that looks across the frontier to the next millennium. You've done both those things tonight. You've given us a noble sense of the variety of endeavor in the past, but you've also given us a sense of the immense challenge ahead for this great past. You've given us a sense, too, that we have much to live up to. I feel that the book that you are about to deliver will have about it not simply the history of LSE, it's not a simple thing, It will deal with the history of LSE, but the way you spoke tonight, you give us some sense of the proportion and the role and the challenge of the social sciences in this country as a whole. I think that's a great thing for us to go away from this evening with. You warn us of the stresses and strains. I always think this building actually is kept up by stresses and strains. Thank you very much, Ralph. We now go to the reception.